Good morning. Happy Sabbath. Today's reading is out of Esther 4, verses 13 through 16. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such time as this?" Then Esther bade them to return to Mordecai this answer: "Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, nights, or day. I also, my maidens, will fast likewise, and so will I go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish."
My preaching has a patriotic theme, and I have given myself the title of self-appointed secretary of veterans and patriotism. And as far as I'm concerned, freedom is just about as close to salvation as what you can get. There's four mutual points that are common to both. In both freedom and salvation, they must start in the heart. Both of them are obtained at high cost. Both of them are maintained only with vigilance and discipline. And for both of them, there's a tendency to take them for granted. In my story I'm going to recite this morning, there's some points that I want you to catch. The purpose is to help us realize the cost of our freedom, to help us realize how God has played a part in the establishment and maintenance of our freedom, and to let us draw inspiration from the devotion of our past heroes, and to see parallels and applications to our Christian experience. I will point out some. You find the rest. April 1942 was not a happy time to be an American. Just 5 months earlier, on December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor had been bombed. A terrible blow to the United States. Following that, Guam, Wake Island, Hong Kong, Singapore, and the Philippines had fallen to the Japanese. Sizable portions of China were occupied, and New Guinea, Australia, and many other regions of the South Pacific were threatened, along with Alaska. And the Bataan Death March had just taken place. No, April 1942 was not a happy time to be an American. Following World War I, America had taken on an isolationist attitude. Our military was far behind the rest of the world. Our planes and much of our equipment were inferior to that of the Japanese. President Roosevelt and a few of our leaders had sensed the need to rearm, but Congress was slow to act, and building our military up was not a fast process. In the Pacific, we had zero battleships, remember Pearl Harbor, and three aircraft carriers. By God's grace, the carriers were not in port during the attack. And all this, what little we had, was against 10 battleships and 10 carriers for Japan. Our efforts to increase military production were lagging, and not too many smiles were seen on the streets of America, and not many grins on the faces of our sailors and soldiers. America was in a malaise. But by the evening of April 18, 1942, there were smiles and grins on land and at sea, and there was jubilation. At 8:20 a.m. on that memorable morning, 600 miles east of Tokyo, the new carrier, USS Hornet, was at sea. Headed into a 36-knot gale with 27 knots of carrier speed, a B-25 Billy Mitchell twin-engine medium bomber sat on the flight deck of the Hornet. It was fully loaded with 2,000 pounds of bomb load, 1,141 gallons of gas, and a five-man crew for a total of 30,000 pounds gross weight. Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle was in command in the left seat. Lieutenant Dick Cole was co-pilot in the right. With the engines revving, when the bow reached the bottom of the swell, the flight officer dropped his flag, Jimmy released the brakes, and plane number one roared down the rising deck and lifted into the air in less than the available 467 feet, the first time that had ever been accomplished. 15 planes followed in intervals of 3 to 5 minutes, and the Jimmy Doolittle Tokyo Raid, as it came to be known, was on its way. James Harold Jimmy Doolittle was born in 1896 in Alameda, California. He grew up in Nome, Alaska, where his parents moved to when he was 4. By the 7th grade, they moved to L.A., where he completed high school. Jimmy had an engaging personality and an ever-present circle of friends. He also had a grin that reached from ear to ear. He graduated from Manual Arts High School in L.A. in 1914, 2 years in engineering classes at a local junior college, 1 year at the University of California at Berkeley. In 1917, with the expectation that America would soon be engaged in the war in Europe, that's World War I, and with a long subdued passion for airplanes and flying, Jimmy joined the U.S. Army to be trained as a pilot. He took to flying as a duck takes to water. At this time, he also married his high school sweetheart, Josephine Daniels, who was a great help to him for the next 70 years. Although he missed the real action of World War I, following the war, he spent hours in the air, perfecting maneuvers, and equally as many hours on the ground in the company of mechanics, tinkering with the engines. 1920, Air Service Mechanic School and Parachute School. 1922, Air Service Engineering School. MIT, Master of Science in Aeronautical Engineering. MIT, Doctor of Science in Aeronautical Engineering. Joe helped him study late at night. He still flew regularly every chance he could. In the 30s, he left the military to work for Shell Oil Company while maintaining his Army Reserve status. During this time, he set long-distance speed records and won many closed-circuit air races. Jimmy changed the course of world aviation with his technological breakthroughs in instrument flying. He is considered the father of instrument flying and in the development of more powerful aviation fuel. By 1941, Jimmy was a legend known around the world. In mid-1941, Jimmy was called back to active military service by General Hap Arnold, who was commander of the Army Air Corps. He was assigned his own P-40 fighter plane to travel around the country, solving production problems in civilian manufacturing plants, making equipment for the Army Air Corps. No great accomplishment is ever accomplished without careful planning and preparation, and with a good leader, that is extremely important. On December 21, 1941, 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt met at the White House with his top military leaders and asked them to investigate the possibility of somehow making a bombing raid on Japan. Two of the Navy leaders came up with the idea of loading Army twin-engine medium bombers on an aircraft carrier, sailing to within 400 miles of Tokyo, launching the planes. Then they would fly them to Tokyo, drop the bombs, and fly on to Allied China, where they could safely land. Jimmy was called into consultation and eagerly accepted the task of organizing and planning the mission. 24 planes and crews were selected from the 17th Bombardment Crew Group, which was currently based in Oregon. The crews flew the planes to Eglin Air Base near Pensacola, Florida. There the men were told only that this was a top secret, extremely dangerous mission, and that anyone that wanted to could drop out. No one did. They had 3 weeks to install three extra gas tanks each, fine-tune the engines for maximum fuel efficiency, and remove unnecessary equipment. Other equipment, including a 20-cent low-level bomb sight developed by one of the crew members, was installed, along with black broom handle fake gun barrels to replace the real ones, which were moved from the rear to save weight. On top of this, pilots and crews had to be trained in short-distance takeoffs, less than 500 feet. One crew got it down to 287 feet. They had to be trained in low-level flying, bob runs, and navigation. To accomplish all this in 3 weeks seems nothing less than a miracle. Jimmy had finagled permission to personally lead the mission, and the passion and courage displayed by him and his crews was fantastic. At this point, his boys, as he referred to them, knew only that the mission was very dangerous. Still, no one dropped out. Ecclesiastes 9:10 reads, "Whatsoever your hand findeth to do, do it with thy might." While all this was taking place, the new carrier Hornet was completing her sea trials in the Caribbean, transited the Panama Canal, and was moving up the Pacific coast. It was time to leave Florida and head to California. Training in low-level flight as they traveled, hedge-hopping, as the flyboys called it. On April 1, 1942, the carrier Hornet was tied up at the wharf in Alameda, California. The planes were landing at the adjacent airstrip and taxiing up to the ship. Plane number 7 was commanded by Ted Lawson, who later wrote the book 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. As they were closing in on the Oakland Bay Bridge on a western approach to Alameda, co-pilot Second Lieutenant Dean Davenport at the controls turned to Lawson and said, "Boss, can I fly under the bridge?" Lawson grinned and said, "Why not?" And they did. What passion. Can you picture God's church with spirit like that? They loaded 16 bombers onto the flight deck with the ship's crane. The carrier's own fighter planes were stored on the hangar deck below, unable to take off and defend the ship as long as the bombers were on the flight deck. On April 2, the carrier, along with the other ships in the task force, about 16 of them, headed out to sea. As the Golden Gate was receding in the distance, it was time to disclose their destination. The klaxon sounded, and Captain Michener, the commander of the Hornet, came on the PA. "Now hear this! Now hear this! This force is bound for Tokyo!" Cheers rang out from every corner of the ship, so loud that they could be heard across the ocean by the other ships of the task force. From that moment on, the men of the Army and Navy were not famous for working close together. I think it might have something to do with the football game every year. From that moment on, they worked together toward a common goal. Now let's come up to our present time in Earth's history for a brief moment. Most of us have heard long ago what our destination is, but we need to be reminded, and our passion needs to be reinvigorated. I'm going to give the congregation a chance to participate now. Now hear this! Now hear this! This force is bound for heaven!
Amen.
You want to try that again? This force is bound for heaven!
Amen.
Thank you. For 2.5 weeks, the carrier force steamed toward Japan under the increasing risk of being detected. The training and maintenance continued while at sea. Gunnery practice took place, bombs were loaded, targets were selected, and pilots, navigators, bombardiers familiarized themselves with landmarks and terrain that they would pass. No one got lost. All of the planes found their targets easily. You make the application. Jimmy Doolittle personally and carefully inspected each plane and cross-examined each crew member. The starboard engine of Lieutenant Don Smith's plane had to be removed, taken below deck, and repaired by the Hornet crew 2 days before takeoff. Had repairs not been completed in time, the plane would have been pushed overboard. On the early morning of April 18, a Japanese picket boat was detected, and a radio message was heard being sent to Japan. From the nearby carrier Enterprise, from which Admiral Bill Halsey commanded the task force, a signal light flashed a message to the Hornet. "Launch planes to Doolittle and Gallant Command. Good luck and God bless you." Within seconds, the Hornet's klaxon split the air, followed by, "Now hear this, now hear this. Army pilots, man your planes." They were 8 hours early and 200 miles further from Tokyo than was intended. But they were ready. Make the application. The planes all launched almost without incident. They flew the 600 plus miles to Tokyo and nearby cities, and with the exception of one plane, encountered little organized resistance. They dropped their bombs on target. No plane was attacked from the rear. The broom handles were effective. The planes flew on towards China, but because of their having to launch early, they were running short on fuel, and they weren't able to reach their planned destination. Most of the crews bailed out over friendly China just before their planes ran out of fuel and crashed. Two crews were not so fortunate. Three died while ditching or bailing out. Eight were captured. Had it not been for a fortuitous tailwind of 25 miles per hour on the last leg of the mission, the results could have been disastrous. Can you see God's hand in this whole mission from beginning to end? Plane number 7, commanded by Ted Lawson, that's the one that flew under the bridge, experienced a very rough water landing several miles behind enemy lines. All of the crew miraculously survived, but were in serious need of medical attention. With the help of friendly peasants and guerrilla warriors, they were transported for 3 days of daring escape and evasion and made it to a small mission hospital, barely within friendly lines. The missionaries gave them loving care, but they had virtually no medical supplies or equipment. The Japanese had stolen all that when they had previously occupied and then retreated. Fortunately, they left, when they took the blood transfusion equipment, they left some kind of antiquated piece that they had, and it was only through that fact that they had left that some of these men were able to survive. Plane number 15, commanded by Lieutenant Don Smith, made a smooth water landing several miles further behind enemy lines than Lawson. Among the crew was Flight Surgeon Doc White. Back in the States, Doc had argued that the mission needed a doctor along, and they found a position for him as a gunner on Smitty's crew. The crew survived without injury and were rescued by the same guerrillas and were taken to the same hospital where Doc White was able to treat the seriously injured crew. Ted Lawson's left leg had received a severe gash, which had become badly infected. After a few days of ineffective treatment, Doc determined that in order to save the pilot's life, he would have to amputate the leg. 2 weeks later, Lawson had recovered enough to travel, and the men moved out, barely keeping ahead of the now advancing Japanese. After several days, they reached safety. Can you see God's hand in all of this? Remember back on the Hornet, that engine that was repaired just in the nick of time? That was Doc's plane. The next day after Jimmy and his crew had bailed out and had been rescued by friendly Chinese, Jimmy and his crew chief, Sergeant Paul Leonard, went out to where their plane had crashed into a nearby hillside. They surveyed the wreckage. Never in his life had Jimmy felt such failure. His own crew was safe, but only God knew where his other boys were. Whether alive or taken prisoner, he presumed all of the planes were wrecked. Jimmy was sitting on the ground next to the wreckage with his head in his hands. Paul sat down next to his boss. "What do you think will happen when you go home, Colonel?" "Well, I guess they'll court-martial me and send me to prison in Fort Leavenworth." "No, sir. I'll tell you what will happen. They're going to make you a general." Jimmy smiled weakly and shook his head. "And," Paul continued, "they are going to give you the Congressional Medal of Honor." Jimmy smiled again, knowing that Paul was trying to cheer him up, but the smile didn't quite reach to his ears. "Colonel, I know they are going to give you another airplane. And when they do, I'd like to fly with you again and be your crew chief." Tears filled Jimmy's eyes and spilled down his cheeks. "Thank you, Paul," Jimmy said. "If I were to have another airplane and you want to be my crew chief, I would be honored to have you." Such devotion. 1 week later, Jimmy was promoted to Brigadier General. A few weeks later, when Jimmy finally made his way to Washington, he was promptly escorted to the White House, where President Roosevelt pinned the Congressional Medal of Honor on him for such a time as this. A few months later, Jimmy was commander of the 12th Air Force in North Africa. Jimmy had flown his assigned B-26 Marauder. That's a sister plane to the B-25. Paul was with him as crew chief. They'd flown to one of the airfields under his command. While Jimmy was in a meeting with the other leaders, the airfield came under aerial attack from the Germans. Paul taxied the plane to the far end of the runway, where he opened fire on the attackers from the top turret machine gun. When the ammunition ran out, he jumped out of the plane and ran to a nearby bomb crater for personal protection. A second bomb landed in the same crater. The cost of our freedom is beyond calculation. Of the eight who were captured, three were executed, one died in captivity. Four of them returned through their sheer determination and the comfort of a lone Bible. One of the four, Bombardier Corporal Jacob D. Schaeser, later returned to Japan after the war as a missionary. He spent 30 years bringing the gospel to the same people who had mistreated him during captivity. One of the men that he converted was the man, and I can't say his name right now, who led the Pearl Harbor raid. This former prisoner of war brought the gospel to this former raider of Pearl Harbor. 80 courageous men conducted this raid. Three of them were from Western New York. One was from the Bronx. I'll read off the New Yorkers. Captain Edward, nicknamed Ski York, pilot of number 8 plane, was from Batavia. Second Lieutenant Harold Doc Watson, pilot of number 9, was from Buffalo. Sergeant Joseph Mansk, engineer on number 5 and gunner, he was from Gowanda. That's a small town south of Buffalo. And Lieutenant George Barr was the navigator of number 6, was from the Bronx. Lieutenant Barr was one of the four who returned after being a prisoner for 40 months. Eighty raiders received the Distinguished Flying Cross, 20 of them posthumously. Four of the pilots became generals. 60 of the raiders returned from the war. They have held a reunion every year for 65 years. This last spring on April 17th through 20th, I had the privilege of attending their 70th reunion, which was held in Dayton, Ohio. Five of the raiders are still surviving. One, however, was not able to travel. I was not able to meet these men personally. I expected that when I went. There was thousands of people there. But to see these men and to hear Lieutenant Dick Cole, Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot, he's now 97, got up and unassisted without cane or walker, with a steady gait, walked the 15 or 20 feet to the podium and gave a short, rousing, patriotic speech that thrilled my heart. The last pilot died a year ago. Jimmy went on to command the mighty 8th Air Force based in England, supported with his planes the D-Day invasion and the European campaign, which culminated with the defeat of Germany. At the conclusion of the war in Europe, he was in the process of transferring his 8th Air Force to the Pacific when Japan surrendered. Jimmy was on the deck of the battleship of Missouri during the ceremony. Along the way, he was promoted 2 more times to Lieutenant General, 3 stars. In 1985, he received, by special act of Congress, his 4th star, the highest rank ever of a reserve officer. President Reagan pinned it on him. In addition to the Congressional Medal of Honor, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the only person ever to be awarded both, plus 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses and more than 20 other medals. Jimmy was loved by his boys, whom he always addressed as son. Jimmy died in 1993 at the age of 96. For such a time as this, he stood 5'4". He was a giant. Some thought of him as a daredevil. No, he was the master of the calculated risk. Jeremiah 29:11, "For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." We are engaged in the great conflict between good and evil. God needs men and women in His cause who will display the courage and bravery such as we have observed of the 80 men on the Doolittle Raid. The men of which were not afraid to head their planes down the heaving, bucking deck of that aircraft carrier into the unknown. Their equipment was less than 100%, leaking gas tanks, gun turrets which were given trouble. But the greatest fear that these men had, to a man, was that they would not be allowed to go on the raid. Men such as Sergeant Ed Horton, turret gunner on plane number 10, commanded by Dick Joyce. When they were low on fuel over China, Joyce ordered the men to bail out, starting with Ed in the rear. "Let me know when you're ready back there, Ed," Joyce called out, "and good luck to you." "Okay, Lieutenant," Horton answered over the interphone. "Here I go, and thanks for a swell ride." Plane number 10 was the only plane to receive damage over Tokyo. From anti-aircraft fire, they had gotten a 7-inch hole in the rear fuselage and bullet holes in the left ring tip. They were pursued by 13 Jap fighters. They had been in the flying for 14 hours, and the gunner, who had received the biggest brunt of all this, thanked the pilot for a swell ride. It is my prayer that each one of us will have the same kind of courage for God and country. Who knows but that we have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. God bless the United States of America, and may God bless His remnant church.